Chapter 5. Pray do not speak to me of weather, not sun, not cloud, not of the places where storms are born. I would not know of wind shivering the heather, nor sleet, nor rain, nor of ancient traces on stone, grey and worn. Pray do not regale the troubles of ill health, not self, not kin, not of the old woman at the road's end. I will spare no time, nor in mercy yield wealth, nor thought, nor feeling, nor shrouds woven to tempt luck's send. Pray tell me of deep chasms crossed, not left, not turned, not of the betrayals breeding like worms. I would you cry out your rage against what is lost, now strong, now to weep, now to make fist and rail on earth so firm. Pray, sing loud the wretched glories of love, now pain, now drunken, now torn from all reason in laughter and tears. I would you bargain with the fey gods above, nor care, nor cost, nor turn of season to wintry fears. Sing to me this, and I will find you unflinching, now knowing, now seeing, now in the face of the howling storm. Sing your life as if a life without ending, and your love, sun's bright fire, on its celestial pace to where truth is born. Pray, an end to inconsequential things. Baedisk of Nathelog. Darujistan, glory's unending. Who could call a single deed inconsequential? This scurrying youth with his arms full of vegetables, the shouts from the stall in his wake, the gauging eye of a guard 30 paces away, assessing the poor likelihood of catching the urchin. Insignificant? Nonsense! Hungry mouths fed, glowing pride, some fewer coins for the hawker, perhaps, but it seemed all profit did was fill a drunken husband's tankard anyway so the bastard could die of thirst for all she cared. A guard's congenitally flawed heart beat on, not yet pushed to bursting by hard pursuit through the crowded market, and so he lives a few weeks longer, enough to complete his full 20 years' service, and so guarantee his wife and children a pension. And of course the one last kiss was yet to come, the kiss that whispered volumes of devotion and all the rest. The pot-thrower in the hut behind the shop, hands and forearms slick with clay, dreaming, yes, of the years in which a life took shape, when each press of a fingertip sent a deep track across a once smooth surface, changing the future, reshaping the past. And was this not as much chance as design? For all that intent could score a path, that the ripples sent up and down and outward could be surmised by decades of experience, was the outcome ever truly predictable? Oh, of course she wasn't thinking any such thing. An ache in her left wrist obliterated all thoughts beyond the persistent ache itself, and what it might portend, and what herbs she would need to brew to ease her discomfort, and how could such concerns be inconsequential? What of the child sitting staring into the doleful eye of a yoked ox outside Corb's womanly charms, where her mother was inside and had been for near a bell now, though of course mother had Uncle Doroth who was a secret for company, which was better than an ox that did nothing but moan? The giant, soft, dark, so dark brown eye stared back, and to think in both directions was obvious. But what was the ox thinking except that the yoke was heavy and the cart even heavier, and it'd be nice to lie down, and what could the child be thinking about but beef stew, and so no little philosopher was born. Although in years to come, why, she'd have her own uncle who was a secret, and thus, like her mother, enjoy all the fruits of marriage with few of the niggling pits. And what of the sun high overhead, bursting with joyous light to bathe the wondrous city like a benediction of all things consequential. Great is the need, so sudden, so pressing, to reach up, close fingers about the fiery orb, to drag it back and back into night and its sprawled darkness, where all manner of things of import have trembled the heavens and the very roots of the earth, or nearly so. Back, then, the short round man demands, for this is his telling, his knowing, his cry of witness, echoing still and still. The night of arrivals, the deeds of the arrived, even as night arrives. Let nothing of consequence be forgot. Let nothing of inconsequence be deemed so, and who now could even imagine such things to exist, recalling with wise nod the urchin thief, the hawker, the guard, the thrower of pots and the child, and the ox and Uncle Doroth with his face between the legs of another man's wife, all to come, excuse, in the day ahead. Mark, too, this teller of the tale, with his sage wink. We are in the midst. Night, shadows overlapping, a most indifferent blur that would attract no one's notice, barring that nuisance of a cat on the sill of the estate, amber eyes tracking now as one shadow moves out from its place of temporary concealment. Out goes this errant shadow across the courtyard into deeper shadows against the estate's wall. Crouching, Torvald Nom looked up to see the cat's head and those damned eyes peering down at him. A moment later, the head withdrew, taking its wide gaze with it. He made his stealthy way to the back corner, paused once more. He could hear the gate guards, a pair of them, arguing over something, tones of suspicion leading to accusation, answered by protestations of denial, but, "Damn you, Doroth, I just don't trust you!"
"No reason not to, Millock. I ever give you one? No."
"To hood you ain't. My first wife
wouldn't leave me alone, I swear. She stalked me like a cat, a rat."
"A rat? Aye, that's about right."
"I swear, Millock, she very nearly raped me."
"The first time." "I know, she told me all about it, with eyes so bright."
"Heard it made you horny as Hood's black scepter."
"That ain't any of your business, Doroth."
And something soft brushed against Torvald's leg. The cat, purring like soft gravel, back bowed, tail writhing. He lifted his foot, held it hovering over the creature, hesitated, then settled it back down. By Apsala's sweet kiss, the kit's eyes and ears might be a boon, come to think of it, assuming it had the nerve to follow him. Torvald eyed the wall, the cornices, the scrollwork metopes, the braided false columns. He wiped sweat from his hands, dusted them with the grit at the wall's base, then reached up for handholds and began to climb. He gained the sill of the window on the upper floor, pulled himself onto it, balanced on his knees. True, never wise, but the fall wouldn't kill him, wouldn't even sprain an ankle, would it? Drawing a dagger, he slipped the blade in between the shutters, carefully felt for the latch. The cat, alighting beside him, nearly pitched him from the sill, but he managed to recover, swearing softly under his breath as he resumed working the lock.
"She still loves you, you know."
"What?"
"She does. She just likes some variety. I tell you, Millock, this last one of yours was no easy conquest."
"You swore!"
"You're my bestest, oldest friend. No more secrets between us. And when I swear to that, as I'm doing now, I mean it true. She's got an appetite, so sharing shouldn't be a problem. I ain't better than you, just different, that's all. Different."
"How many times a week, Doroth? Tell me true."
"Oh, every second day or so."
"But I'm every second day, too."
"Odd even, I guess. Like I said, an appetite."
"I'll say."
"After shift, let's go get drunk."
"Aye, we can compare and contrast."
"I love it. Just that, ha!" "Hey, Millock."
"Aye?"
"How old's your daughter?"
The latch clicked, springing free the shutters just as a sword hissed from a scabbard, and, amidst wild shouting, a fight was underway at the gate.
"A joke! Honest! Just a joke, Millock!"
Voices now from the front of the house as Torvald slid his dagger blade between the lead windows and lifted the inside latch. He quickly edged into the dark room as boots rapped on the compound and more shouting erupted at the front gate. A lantern crashed and someone's sword went flying to skitter away on the cobbles. Torvald quickly closed the shutters, then the window. The infernal purring was beside him, a soft jaw rubbing against a knee. He reached for the cat, fingers twitching, hesitated, then withdrew his hand. "Pay attention to the damned thing, right. So when it hears what can't be heard, and when it sees what can't be seen, yes." Pivoting in his crouch, he scanned the room. Some sort of study, though most of the shelves were bare. Overreaching ambition, this room, a sudden lurch towards culture and sophistication, but of course it was doomed to failure. Money wasn't enough. Intelligence helped. Taste, an inquisitive mind, an interest in other stuff. Stuff out of immediate sight, stuff having nothing to do with whatever. Wasn't enough to simply send some servant to scour some scrollmonger's shop and say, "I'll take that shelf's worth and that one too." Master's not too discriminating, yes. Master probably can't even read, so what difference does it make? He crept over to the one shelf on which were heaped a score or so scrolls, along with one leather-bound book. Each scroll was rolled tight, tied with some seller's label, just as he had suspected. Torvald began reading through them. "Treatise on Drainage Grooves in Stone Gutters of Gadrobi District. 19th report in the Year of the Shrew. Extraordinary Subjects. Guild of Quarry Engineering. Author, Member 322. Tales of Pambi Doty and the World Inside the Trunk, with illustrations by some dead man. The Lost Verses of Anamandaris, with annotation." Torvald's brows rose, since this one might actually be worth something. He quickly slipped the string off and unfurled the scroll. The vellum was blank, barring a short annotation at the bottom that read, "No scholarly erudition is possible at the moment," and a publisher's mark denoting this scroll as part of a series of lost works published by the Vellum Makers Guild of Pale. He rolled the useless thing back up, plucked out one more. "An illustrated guide to headgear of cobblers of Genabaris in the 4th century, Burns Sleep, by Cracktooth Filcher, self-avowed serial collector and scourge of cobblers imprisoned for life. A publication of Prisoner's Pit Library, Nathelog." He had no doubt the illustrations were lavish and meticulous, detailed to excess, but somehow his curiosity was not up to the challenge of perusal. By now the commotion at the gate had been settled. Various members of the guard had returned from the fracas, with much muttering and cursing that fell away abruptly as soon as they entered the main house on their way to their rooms, telling Torvald that the master was indeed home and probably asleep. Which was something of a problem, given just how paranoid the bastard was, and as the likely hiding place of his trove was somewhere in his damned bedroom. Well, the world presented its challenges, and without challenges life was worthless and pointless and, most crucially, devoid of interest. He moved to the door leading to the hallway, pausing to wrap a cloth about his face, leaving only his eyes free. The cat watched intently. Lifting the latch, he tugged the door open and peered out into the corridor. Left, the outer back wall not 3 paces away. Right, the aisle reaching all the way through the house. Doors and a central landing for the staircase. And a guard seated facing that landing. Black hair, red bulbous nose, protruding lower lip, and enough muscles slabbed onto a gigantic frame to fill out 2 or 3 Torvald noms. The fool was knitting, his mouth moving and brow knotting as he counted stitches. And there was the horrid cat, padding straight for him. Torvald quietly closed the door. He should have strangled the thing. From the corridor he heard a grunting curse, then boots thumping down the stairs. Opening the door once more, he looked out. The guard was gone, the knitting lying on the floor with one strand leading off down the stairs. Ha! Brilliant cat! Why, if he met it again, he'd kiss it, but nowhere near where it licked itself, because there were limits, after all, and anywhere a cat could lick itself was nowhere he'd kiss. Torvald quickly closed the door behind him and tiptoed up the corridor, a cautious glance down the wide central staircase. Wherever the cat had run off with the ball of wool, it was out of sight, and so too the guard. He faced the ornate double doors directly behind the vacated wooden chair. Locked? Yes. He drew his dagger and slid the thin blade between the doors. Ornate decoration was often accompanied by neglect of the necessary mechanisms, and this lock followed the rule, as he felt the latch lift away. Boots sounded downstairs. He tugged open the door and quickly slipped inside, crouching once more. A front room, an office of sorts, with a single lantern on a short wick casting faint light across the desk and its strewn heap of papyrus sheets. A second door, smaller, narrow, behind the desk's high-backed plush chair. Torvald Nom tiptoed towards it, pausing at the desk to douse the lantern, waiting for his eyes to adjust to the darkness, crouching yet lower to squint at the crack beneath the bedroom door, pleased to find no thread of light. Drawing up against the panelled wood with its gold leaf insets now dull in the gloom. No lock this time, hinges feeling well-oiled, he slowly worked the door open. Inside, quietly shutting the door behind him. Soft breathing from the huge four-poster bed, then a sigh.
Sweet sliver fishy, is that you?
A woman's husky, whispering voice, and now stirring sounds from the bed.
The Night Stalker this time? Ooh, that one's fun. I'll keep my eyes closed and whimper lots when you threaten me to stay quiet. Hurry, I'm lying here, petrified. Someone's in my room.
Torvald Nom hesitated, truly torn between necessity and, well, necessity. He untied his rope belt and, in a hissing voice, demanded,
First, the treasure! Where is it, woman?
She gasped.
That's a good voice. A new one. The treasure, ah. You know where it is, you horrible creature. Right here between my legs.
Torvald rolled his eyes.
Not that one, the other one. If I don't tell you, then I will have my way with you. Oh, I say nothing. Please.
Damn, he sure messed that one up. There was no way she'd not know he wasn't who he was pretending to be, even when that someone was pretending to be someone else. How to solve this?
Get on your stomach. Now, on your hands and knees. Yes, like that. You're worse than an animal.
Torvald paused at the foot of the bed. Worse than an animal? What did that mean? Shaking his head, he climbed onto the bed. Well, here goes nothing. A short time later,
Sliver fishy, the new elixir? Gods, it's spectacular. Why, I can't call you sliver fishy anymore, can I? More like a salmon, charging upstream. Oh!
The treasure, or I'll use this knife.
And he pressed the cold blade of the dagger against the outside of her right thigh. She gasped again.
Under the bed! Don't hurt me! Keep pushing, damn you! Harder! This one's going to make a baby! I know it! This time a baby!
Well, he did his part, anyway, feeding his coins into the temple's cup and all that, and may her prayers guide her true into motherhood's blissful heaven. She collapsed onto the bed, groaning, while he backed off, knelt on the cold wooden floor and reached under the bed, knuckles skinning against a large, low long box. Groping, he found one handle and dragged it out. She moaned.
Oh, don't start counting again, darling. Please, you ruin everything when you do that.
Not counting, woman. Stealing. Stay where you are. Eyes closed. Don't move.
It just sounds silly now, you know that.
Shut up, or I'll do you again.
Ah, what was that elixir again?
He prized open the lock with the tip of the dagger. Inside, conveniently stored in burlap sacks tagged with precise amounts, a fortune of gems, jewels, and high councils. He quickly collected the loot.
You are counting.
I warned you.
He climbed back onto the bed. Looked down and saw that promises weren't quite enough.
Gods below, if you only were.
Listen, he said. I need more elixir. In the office. Don't move.
I won't. I promise.
He hurried out, crept across the outer room and paused at the doors to the corridor to press his ear against the panel. Softly, the slither click of bamboo knitting needles. Torvald slid the dagger into its scabbard, reversed grip, opened the door, looked down at the top of the guard's hairy head, and swung hard. The pommel crunched. The man sagged in his chair, then folded into a heap at the foot of the chair. The cat was waiting by the library door. Uncle One, Uncle Two, Father None. Aunt One, Aunt Two, Mother None. Present and on duty, Uncle One, Aunt One, and Cousins One, Two, Three. Cousin One edging closer, almost close enough for another hard, sharp jab with an elbow, as One made to collect another onion from the heap on the table. But he knew One's games, had a year's list of bruises to prove it, and so, just as accidentally, he took a half-step away, keeping on his face a beaming smile as Aunt One cooed her delight at this sudden bounty, and Uncle One sat opposite, ready to deliver his wink as soon as he glanced over, which he wouldn't do yet because timing, as Uncle Two always told him, was everything. Besides, he needed to be aware of Cousin One, especially now that the first plan had been thwarted. One, whose name was Snell, would have to work harder in his head, work that cunning which seemed to come from nowhere and wasn't part of the dull stupidity that was One's actual brain. So maybe it was demons after all, clattering and chittering all their cruel ideas. Snell wouldn't let this rest, he knew. No, he'd remember and start planning, and the hurt would be all the worse for that. But right now he didn't care, not about Cousin One, not about anything that might come later tonight or tomorrow. He'd brought food home, after all, an armload of food, delivering his treasure to joyous cries of relief. And the man whose name he'd been given, the man long dead who was neither Uncle One nor Uncle Two, but had been Uncle Three, and not, of course, Father One, well, that man would be proud that the boy with his name was doing what was needed to keep the family together. Collecting his own onion, the child named Harlow made his way to a safe corner of the single room, and, moments before taking a bite, glanced up to meet Uncle One's eyes, to catch the wink and then nod in answer. Just like Uncle Two always said, timing was how a man measured the world and his place in it. Timing wasn't a maybe world, it was a world of yes and no, this, not that. Now, not later. Timing belonged to all the beasts of nature that hunted other creatures. It belonged to the tiger and its fixed, watching eyes. It belonged, too, to the prey, when the hunter became hunted, like with Cousin One, each moment a contest, a battle, a duel. But Harlow was learning the tiger's way, thanks to Uncle Two, whose very skin could change into that of a tiger when anger awakened, cold and deadly, who had a tiger's eyes and was the bravest, wisest man in all of Darujistan. And the only one, apart from young Harlow himself, who knew the truth of Aunt Two, who wasn't Aunt Two at all, but Mother One, even if she wouldn't admit it, wouldn't ever say it, and wouldn't have hardly nothing to do with her only child, her son of rape. Once, Harlow had thought that rape was his father's name, but now he knew it was a thing people did to other people, as mean as an elbow in the ribs, maybe meaner. And that was why Mother One stayed Aunt Two. And why on those rare occasions she visited, she wouldn't meet Harlow's eyes, no matter how he tried, and why she wouldn't say anything about nothing except with a voice that was all anger.
"Aunt Stoney hates words, Harlow," Gruntle had explained, "but only when those words creep too close to her, to where she hides, you see."
Yes, he saw. He saw plenty. Snell caught his eye and made a wicked face, mouthing vicious promises. His little sister, Cousin Two, whose name was Mew, was watching from where she held on to the table edge, seeing but not understanding, because how could she, being only 3 years old? While Cousin Three, another girl but this one named Hinty, was all swathed in the cradle and safe in there, safe from everything, which was how it should be for the littlest ones. Harlow was 5, maybe close to 6, but already tall.
"Stretched," laughed Gruntle. "Stretched and scrawny, because that's how boys grow."
Aunt Merla had the rest of the vegetables in a steaming pot over the hearth, and Harlow saw her flick a knowing look at her husband, who nodded, not pausing in massaging the stumps below his knees, where most people had shins and ankles and then feet. But Uncle Bedeck had had an accident, which was something like rape, only not on purpose. And so he couldn't walk anymore, which made life hard for them all, and meant Harlow had to do what was needed since Snell didn't seem interested in doing anything. Except torment Harlow, of course. The air in the cramped room was smelling earthy and sweet now, as Merla fed more dung onto the small hearth beneath the pot. Harlow knew he'd have to go out and collect more come the morrow, and that might mean right out of the city, up along the west shore of the lake, which was an adventure. Snell finished his onion and crept closer to Harlow, hands tightening into fists. But Harlow had already heard the boots in the alley outside, crackling on the dead fronds from the collapsed roof opposite, and a moment later Uncle Two swept the hanging aside and leaned into the room, the barbs on his face looking freshly painted, so stark were they, and his eyes glowed like candle flames. His smile revealed fangs. Bedeck waved.
"Gruntle, do come in, old friend. See how Merla readies a feast."
"Well timed, then," the huge man replied, entering the room, "for I have brought smoked horse."
Seeing Harlow, he waved the boy over.
"Need to put some muscle on this one."
"Oh," said Merla, "he never sits still, that's his problem, not for a moment."
Snell was scowling, scuttling in retreat and looking upon Gruntle with hatred and fear. Gruntle picked up Harlow, then held him squirming under one arm as he took the two steps to the hearth to hand Merla a burlap-wrapped package. Bedeck was eyeing Gruntle.
"Glad you made it back," he said in a low voice. "Heard about you at the gate and that moment in Worrytown. Damn, but I wish I wasn't so useless."
Setting Harlow down, Gruntle sighed.
"Maybe your days of riding with caravans are done, but that doesn't make you useless. You're raising a fine family, Bedeck. A fine family."
"I ain't raising nothing,"
Bedeck muttered, and Harlow knew that tone, knew it all too well, and it might be days, maybe even a week, before Uncle One climbed back up from the dark, deep hole he was now in. The problem was, Bedeck liked that place. Liked the way Merla closed round him, all caresses and embraces and soft murmurings, and it'd go on like that until the night came when they made noises in their bed, and come the next morning, why, Bedeck would be smiling. When Merla was like that, though, when she was all for her husband and nothing else, it fell to Harlow to tend to the girls and do everything that was needed, and worst of all, it meant no one was holding back Snell. The beatings would get bad then. Merla couldn't work much, not since the last baby, when she'd hurt something in her belly and now she got tired too easy, and even this glorious supper she was creating would leave her exhausted and weak with a headache. When able, she'd mend clothes, but that wasn't happening much of late, which made Harlow's raiding the local markets all the more important. He stayed close to Gruntle, who now sat opposite Uncle Bedeck and had produced a jar of wine, and this kept Snell away for now. Which of course only made things worse later, but that was all right. You couldn't choose your family, after all, not your cousins, not anyone. They were there, and that was that. Besides, he could leave early tomorrow morning, so early Snell wouldn't even be awake, and he'd make his way out of the city, out along the lake shore, where the world stretched away, where beyond the shanties there were hills with nothing but goats and shepherds, and beyond even them there was nothing but empty land. That such a thing could exist whispered to Harlow of possibilities, ones that he couldn't hope to name or put into words, but were all out in the future life that seemed blurry, ghostly, but a promise even so. As bright as Gruntle's eyes, that promise, and it was that promise that Harlow held on to when Snell's fists were coming down. Bedeck and Gruntle talked about the old days, when they'd both worked the same caravans, and it seemed to Harlow that the past, a world he'd never seen because it was before the rape, was a place of great deeds, a place thick with life where the sun was brighter, the sunsets were deeper, the stars blazed in a black sky, and the moon was free of mists, and men stood taller and prouder, and nobody had to talk about the past back then, because it was happening right now. Maybe that was how he would find the future, a new time in which to stand tall. A time he could stretch into. Across from Harlow, Snell crouched in a gloomy corner, his eyes filled with their own promise as he grinned at Harlow. Merla brought them plates heaped with food. The papyrus sheets, torn into shreds, lit quickly, sending black flakes upward in the chimney's draft, and Dyker watched them go, seeing crows, thousands of crows. Thieves of memory, stealing everything else he might have thought about, might have resurrected to ease the uselessness of his present life. All the struggles to recall faces had been surrendered, and his every effort to write down this dread history had failed. Words flat and lifeless, scenes described in the voice of the dead. Who were those comrades at his side back then? Who were those Wiccans and Malazans, those warlocks and warriors, those soldiers and sacrificial victims who perched above the road, like sentinels of futility, staring down at their own marching shadows? Balt, Lull, Sormo Enath, Coltane. Names, then, but no faces. The chaos and terror of fighting, of reeling in exhaustion, of wounds slashed open and bleeding, of dust and the reek of spilled wastes. No, he could not write of that, could not relate the truth of it, any of it.
Memory fails, forever doomed as we seek to fashion scenes. Framed, each act described, reasoned and reasonable, irrational and mad. But somewhere beneath there must be the thick, solid sludge of motivation, of significance, of meaning. There must be. The alternative is unacceptable.
But this was where his attempts delivered him again and again. The unacceptable truths, the ones no sane person could ever face, could ever meet eye to eye. That nothing was worth revering, not even the simple fact of survival, and certainly not that endless cascade of failures, of deaths beyond counting. Even here, in this city of peace, he watched the citizens in all their daily dances, and with each moment that passed, his disdain deepened. He disliked the way his thoughts grew ever more uncharitable, ever more baffled by the endless scenes of seemingly mindless, pointless existence. But there seemed no way out of that progression as his observations unveiled the pettiness of life, the battles, silent and otherwise, with wives, husbands, friends, children, parents, with the very crush on a crowded street, each life closed round itself, righteous and uncaring of strangers. People fully inside their own lives. Yet should he not revel in such things? In their profound freedom, in their extraordinary luxury of imagining themselves in control of their own lives? Of course they weren't. In freedom, such as each might possess, they raised their own barriers, carried shackles fashioned by their own hands, rattling the chains of emotions, of fears and worries, of need and spite, of the belligerence that railed against the essential anonymity that gripped a person. Aye, a most unacceptable truth. Was this the driving force behind the quest for power? To tear away anonymity, to raise fame and infamy up like a blazing shield and shining sword, to voice a cry that would be heard beyond the gates of one's own life? But oh, Dyker had heard enough such cries. He had stood cowering in the midst of howls of defiance and triumph, all turning sour with despair, with senseless rage. The echoes of power were uniform, yes, in their essential emptiness. Any historian worthy of the title could see that. No, there was no value in writing, no more effect than a babe's fists battering at the silence that ignored every cry. History meant nothing, because the only continuity was human stupidity. Oh, there were moments of greatness, of bright deeds, but how long did the light of such glory last? From one breath to the next, aye, and no more than that, no more than that.
As for the rest, kick through the bones and wreckage, for they are what remain, what lasts until all turns to dust.
You are looking thoughtful, Mallet observed, leaning forward with a grunt to top up Dyker's tankard. "Which, I suppose, should not come as a surprise, since you just burned the efforts of most of a year, not to mention a High Council's worth of papyrus."
"I will reimburse you the cost," Dyker said.
"Don't be ridiculous," the healer said, leaning back. "I only said you looked thoughtful."
"Appearances deceive, Mallet. I am not interested in thinking any more about anything."
"Good. Then this is a true meeting of minds." Dyker continued studying the fire, continued watching the black crows wing up the chimney.
"For you, unwise," he said, "you have assassins to consider."
Mallet snorted. "Assassins? Ansi's already talking about digging up a dozen cussers. Blend's out hunting down the guild's headquarters, while Picker and Blue Pearl work with Councillor Cole to sniff out the source of the contract. Give it all a week and the problem will cease being a problem. Permanently." Dyker half smiled.
"Don't mess with Malazan Marines, retired or otherwise.
You'd think people would know by now, wouldn't you?"
"People are stupid, Mallet."
The healer winced. "Not all of us."
"True. But Hood waits for everyone. Stupid, smart, witty, witless. Waits with the same knowing smile."
"No wonder you burned your book, Dyker."
"Yes."
"So, since you're no longer writing history, what will you do?"
"Do? Why, nothing."
"Now that's something I know all about. Oh, don't even try to object. I heal someone every now and then, but I was a soldier once, and now I'm not. Now I sit around getting fat, and it's fat poisoned through and through with some kind of cynical bile. I lost all my friends, Dyker. No different from you. Lost them all, and for what? Damned if I know. Damned and damned again, but no. I don't know the why of it, the why of anything."
"A meeting of minds, indeed," Dyker said. "Then again, Mallet, it seems you are at war once more, against the usual implacable deadly enemy."
"The Guild? I suppose you're right. But it won't last long, will it? I don't like being retired. It's like announcing an end to your worth, whatever that worth was. And the longer you go on, the more you realize that that worth wasn't worth anything like you once thought it was. And that just makes it worse." Dyker set down his tankard and rose.
"The High Alchemist has invited me to lunch on the morrow. I'd best go to bed and get some sleep. Watch your back, healer. Sometimes the lad pushes and the lady's nowhere in sight."
Mallet simply nodded, having assumed the burden of staring at the fire now that Dyker was leaving. The historian walked away from the warmth, passing through draughts and layers of chill air on his way to his room, colder and colder with every step. Somewhere above this foul temple, crows danced with sparks above the mouth of a chimney, virtually unseen in the darkness. Each one carried a word, but the sparks were deaf, too busy with the ecstasy of their own bright, blinding fire, at least until they went out. Gaz stormed out early, as soon as he realized he wasn't going to get enough coin from the day's take to buy a worthwhile night of drinking. Thordi watched her husband go, that pathetic forward tilt of the man's walk which always came when he was enraged, the jerky strides as he marched out into the night. Where he went, she had no idea, nor, truth be told, did she even care. Twice now in the past week, that skinny mite of an urchin had raided her vegetable stand. Gods, what were parents up to these days? The runt was probably 5 years old, no older, that's for sure, and already fast as an eel in the shallows. And why wasn't he leashed as a child should be, especially at that age when there were plenty of people who'd snatch him, use him or sell him quick as can be? And if they used him in that bad way, then they'd wring his neck afterwards, which thought he might not mind so much, except that it was a cruel thought and a cruel picture, and more like something her husband would think than her. Though he'd only be thinking in terms of how much money she might make without the thieving going on, and maybe what he might do if he ever got his hands on the runt. She shivered at that thought, then was distracted by Nu, the watchdog, in the garden next to hers, an unusual eruption of barking. But then she remembered her husband and his walk, and how Nu hated Gaz, especially when he walked like that. When Gaz stumbled back home, drunk and useless, the mangy dog never made a sound, ignored Gaz straight out, in fact. Dogs, she knew, could smell bad intentions. Other animals too, but especially dogs. Gaz never touched Thordy, not even a shove or a slap, because without her and the garden she tended, he was in trouble, and he knew that well enough. He'd been tempted many times, oh yes, but there'd be, all of a sudden, a glint in his eyes, a surprise, flickering a light. And he'd smile and turn away, saving that mangled fist and all that was behind it for someone else. Gaz liked a good fight in some alley behind a tavern, liked kicking faces in, so long as the victim was smaller than he was and more drunk, and without any friends who might step in or come up from behind. It was how he dealt with the misery of his life, or so he said often enough. Thordy wasn't sure what all that misery was about, though she had some ideas. Her, for one, the pathetic patch of ground she had for her vegetables, her barren womb, the way age and hard work was wearing her down, stealing the glow she'd once had. Oh, there was plenty about her that made him miserable. And, all things considered, she'd been lucky to have him for so long, especially when he'd worked the nets on that fisher boat, the nets that, alas, had taken all his fingers that night when something big had waited down below, motionless and so unnoticed as the crew hauled the net aboard. Then it exploded in savage power, making for the river like a battering ram. Gaz's fingers, all entwined, sprang like topped carrots, and now he had thumbs and rows of knuckles and nothing else. Fists made for fighting, he'd say, with an unconscious baring of his teeth.
That and nothing more.
And that was true enough, and good reason, she supposed, for getting drunk every chance he could. Lately, however, she'd been feeling a little less generous. No, she'd been feeling not much of anything at all. Even pity had dwindled, whispered away like a dry leaf on the autumn wind. And it was as if he had changed right in front of her eyes, though she now understood that what had changed was behind her eyes, not the one looked at, but the one doing the looking. She no longer recoiled in the face of his fury, no longer shied from that marching tilt and all its useless anger, and would now study it, seeing its futility, seeing the self-pity in that wounded pitch. She was empty then, and she had first thought she would remain so, probably for the rest of her life. Instead, something had begun to fill the void. At first, it arrived with a start, a twinge of guilt, but not any more. Now, when thoughts of murder filled her head, it was like immersing herself in a scented bath. Gaz was miserable. He said so. He'd be happier if he were dead. And, truth be told, so would she. All this love, all this desperate need, and he was useless. She should have driven him out of her life long ago, and he knew it. Holding on to him the way she was doing was torture. He'd told her he only fought weaklings, fools and worse. He told her he did it to keep his arms strong, to harden his knuckles, to hold on to, ha, that was a good one, some kind of reason for staying alive. A man needs a skill, aye, and no matter if it was good or bad, no matter at all. But the truth was, he chose the meanest, biggest bastards he could find, proving he could, proving those knuckles and their killing ways. Killing, aye. Four, so far, that he was sure of. Sooner or later, Gaz knew, the coin would flip, and it would be his cold corpse lying face down in some alley. Well enough. When you pay out more than you're worth, again and again, eventually somebody comes to collect. She'd not mourn him, he knew. A man in love could see when the one he loved stopped loving him back. He did not blame her and did not love her any less. No, his need just got worse. The Blue Ball Tavern occupied one corner of a massive, decrepit heap of tenements that stank of urine and rotting rubbish. In the midst of the fate, the nightly anarchy on these back streets up from the docks reached new heights, and Gaz was not alone in hunting the alleys for trouble. It occurred to him that maybe he wasn't as unusual as he might have once believed, that maybe he was just one among thousands of useless thugs in this city, all of them hating themselves and out sniffing trails like so many mangy dogs. Those who knew him gave him space, slinking back from his path as he stalked towards his chosen fighting grounds behind the Blue Ball. That brief thought about other people, about the shadowed faces he saw around him, was short-lived, flitting away with the first smell of blood in the damp, sultry air. Someone had beaten him to it, and might even now be swaggering out the opposite end of the alley. Well, maybe the fool might circle back, and he could deliver to the bastard what he'd done to somebody else. And there was the body, the huddled, motionless shape. Walking up, Gaz nudged it with one boot, heard a blood-frothed wheeze, slammed his heel down on the ribcage just to hear the snap and crunch, a cough spraying blood, a low groan, then a final exhalation. Done. Easy as that.
Are you pleased, Gaz?
He spun round at the soft, deep voice, forearms lifting into a guard he expected to fail. But the fist he thought was coming never arrived, and swearing he stepped back until his shoulders thudded against the wall, glad in growing fear at the tall, shrouded figure standing before him.
I ain't afraid, he said in a belligerent growl.
Amusement washed up against him like a wave.
Open yourself, Gaz. Your soul. Welcome your god.
Gaz could feel the air on his teeth, could feel his lips stretching until cracks split to ooze blood. His heart hammered at his chest.
I ain't got no god. I'm nothing but curses, and I don't know you. Not at all.
Of course you do, Gaz. You have made sacrifice to me 6 times now, and counting.
Gaz could not see the face within the hood, but the air between them was suddenly thick with some pungent, cloying scent. Like cold mud, the kind that ran in turgid streams behind slaughterhouses. He thought he heard the buzz of flies, but the sound was coming from somewhere inside his own head.
I don't kill for you, he said, his voice thin and weak.
You don't have to. I do not demand sacrifices. There is no need. You mortals consecrate any ground you choose, even this alley. You drain a life onto it. Nothing more is required. Not intent, not prayer, nor invocation. I am summoned without end.
What do you want from me?
For now, only that you continue harvesting souls. When the time comes for more than that, Gaz of the Gadrobi, you will be shown what must be done.
And if I don't want...
Your wants are not relevant.
He couldn't get that infernal buzzing out of his skull. He shook his head, squeezed shut his eyes for a moment. When he opened them again, the god was gone.
The flies! The flies are in my head! Gods, get out!
Someone had wandered into the alley, weaving, mumbling, one hand held out to fend off any obstacles.
I can get them out, yes!
And all at once he knew the truth of that, knew that killing would silence those cursed flies. Swinging round, he pitched forward, hands lifting, and fast marched towards the drunken fool, who looked up at the last moment, in time to meet those terrible knuckles. Crute of Taliant slowed as he approached the recessed entrance to the tenement where he now lived. Someone was standing in the shadows, blocking the door. He halted 10 paces away.
That was good work, he said. You was behind me most of the way, making me think you wasn't good at all. But now here you are.
Hello, Kroot. At that voice, Kroot started, then leaned forward, trying to pierce the gloom. Nothing but a shape, but it was, he concluded, the right shape.
Gods below, I never thought you'd come back. Do you have any idea what's happened since you vanished?
No. Why don't you tell me?
Kroot grinned. I can do that, but not out here.
You once lived in a better neighborhood, Kroot. He watched Ralik Nom step out from the alcove and his grin broadened.
You ain't changed at all. And yes, I've known better times, and I hate to say it, but you're to blame, Ralik.
The tall, gaunt assassin turned to study the tenement building. You live here, and it's my fault.
Come on, Kroot said. Let's get inside. Top floor, of course, an alley corner. Easy to the roof, dark as Hood's armpit. You'll love it.
A short time later, they sat in the larger of the two rooms, a scarred table between them, on which sat a stubby candle with a badly smoking wick and a clay jug of sour ale. The two assassins held tin cups, both of which leaked. Since pouring the ale, Kroot had said nothing, but now he grunted in amused surprise.
I just thought of something. You showing up, alive and hale, has just done what Krafar couldn't do. We had a cult, Ralik Nom, worshipping the memory of you. Krafar outlawed it in the guild, then tried to eradicate it, forced us deeper. Not deep enough for me. I'm under suspicion, and they've gone and isolated me, like I was already dead. Old contacts look right through me, Ralik. It's been damned hard. Krafar, Seba, Talo's brood. In the squabble over who was going to take over after Vorkan, he's the one got through unscathed. Still breathing, I mean. The guild's decimated, Ralik. Infighting, lots of good killers getting disgusted and just up and leaving. Down to Ellingarth, mostly, with a few to Black Coral, if you can believe that. Even heard rumours that some went to Pale to join the Malazan Claws. Ralik held up a red-stained hand. A moment, damn you! What idiot decided on a cult? Kroot shrugged. Just sort of happened, Ralik. Not really worship, that was the wrong word. It's more like a philosophy of assassination. No magic, for one. Poisons, lots of poisons, and Otateral dust, if we can get it. But Seba Krafar wants to take us back to all that magic, even though you made it obvious which way was the better one, the surer one. The man's stubborn. It's in the blood with them, eh? Kroot slapped the table, momentarily knocking over the candle, which he hastened to right before the paltry flame went out. Can't wait to see Krafar's face when you walk in.
You will have to, Ralik replied. Something else, friend. You don't say a word to anyone. Kroot smiled knowingly.
You plan on an ambush, don't you? You stepping over Krafar's body to take mastery of the guild. And you need to make plans, and I can help you there. Tell you the ones sure to be loyal to you, sure to back you.
Be quiet, Ralik said. There's something you need to know.
What?
The night I disappeared. Recall it?
Of course.
Someone else vanished that night, too.
Kroot blinked. Well, yes.
And now I am back.
You are.
Ralik drank down a mouthful of ale, then another. Kroot stared, then swore.
Her, too?
Yes. Draining his cup, Kroot quickly refilled it, then leaned back.
Gods below. Poor Krafar. You working with her on this, Ralik?
No.
Not that she'd need help.
I don't know where she is, Kroot. I don't know what she's planning, if anything. I don't know and can't guess, and neither can you.
So, what do we do, Ralik?
You change nothing. Stay with your routine. Kroot snorted.
What routine? Slow starvation?
I have coin, enough for both of us, hidden here and there.
Ralik rose.
I assume the rooftops are quiet these nights.
Except for thieves, coming out like mice with not an owl to be seen. Like I said, the guild's on its knees.
All right, I will return before dawn. For now, Kroot, we do nothing.
I'm good at that.
Ralik grimaced, but said nothing as he turned to the window and unlocked the shutters. He didn't need to say anything, as far as Kroot was concerned. True enough, Kroot was good at doing nothing, but Ralik Nom wasn't. He wasn't good at that at all.
Oh, this is going to be fun, isn't it?
The murmurings chased him down the alley, guttural noises issuing from a score of fanged mouths, tongues wiggling, black lips lifting clear. The glimmer and flash of rolling eyes in the gloom. Looking back over one shoulder, Iskaral passed, Magus and High Priest of Shadow, Bokaral God, made faces at his worshippers. He cursed them in twitters, he waggled his tongue, he bared his teeth and bulged his eyes. And did this frighten them off? Why, no. The very opposite, if such madness could be believed. They scrabbled ever closer, still clutching their loot from hapless victims in the markets, their faces writhing in constipated anguish or something equally dire, infuriating.
Never mind them. I have tasks, missions, deeds of great import. I have stuff to do.
And so he hurried on, kicking through rubbish, listening to the creatures behind him kicking through the same rubbish. He paused at each alley mouth, shot quick glances up and down the streets, then darted across to the next opening. In his wake, the Bokarala gathered in a clump at the alley mouths, looked one way, looked the other, and then tore off in pursuit. A short time later, he skidded to a halt, the sound of his heels echoed a moment later by countless claws gouging cobblestones. Iskaral passed, pulled at his hair and whirled. The crouching Bokarala all had their knobby fists up to either side of their tiny skulls.
"Leave me be!"
he hissed. They hissed back at him. He spat and was sprayed with gobs of foul saliva. He beat at his head. They pounded their own heads with fistfuls of jewelry and globes of fruit. Eyes narrowing, Iskaral Past slowly stood on one leg, watched the Bokarala stand tottering on single legs.
"Gods below," he muttered. "They've all gone entirely insane."
Spinning round once more, he glared across at the squat octagonal temple 50 paces down the street to his right. Its walls were a chaotic collection of niches and misshapen angles, a veritable plethora of shadows. Iskaral Past sighed.
"My new abode. A modest hovel, but it suits my needs. I plan to do it up, of course, when there's time. Oh, you like the gold place settings and silk napkins? Just something I threw together, mind, but it pleases me well enough. Spiders? No spiders round here. Oh, no. Simply not allowed. Ghastly creatures. Yes, disgusting. Never bathe, don't you know? Ghastly."
Wordless sing-song at his back.
"Oh, don't mind them, my ex-wife's relations. If I'd have known, well, of course, I'd never have taken the leap, if you know what I mean. But that's how it is. Get married and you end up saddled with the whole family menagerie. And even though she's gone now, nothing but a dried-out husk with her legs sticking up in the air, well, I admit to feeling responsible for her hapless kin. No, she looked nothing like them. Worse, actually. I confess to a momentary insanity. The curse of being young, I suppose. When did we get married? Why, 4 or 5 years ago now, yes. Only seems like a lifetime, and I'm glad, so glad, to be done with it now. More wine, sweetness?"
Smiling, Iskaral Past set out for the temple. Shadowed steps leading to a shadowed landing beneath a pitted lintel stone. Oh, this was all very well done. The twin doors were huge, very nearly gates, panelled in polished bronze, moulded into an enormous image of charging hounds. Delicious touch, lovingly rendered, all that snarling terror.
Yes, the doors were my idea, by my own hand, in fact. I dabble. Sculpture, tapestry, portraiture, caricature, potterature. Pottery, I mean. I was simply using the technical term. See this funerary urn? Exquisite, yes. She's inside. Yes, my beloved departed. My belovedly departed. My blessedly departed. Oh, folding up her limbs was no easy task, let me tell you. Quite a tight fit. I know, hard to believe she's in there, in an urn barely larger than a jar of wine. I have many skills, yes, as befits the most glorious mortal servant of High House Shadow. But I'll tell you this, she fought hard all the way in.
He crouched in front of the bronze doors, glowering into the gaping jaws of the hounds, reached up one knuckled hand and rapped Baran's nose, a faint, hollow reverberation.
I knew it, he said, nodding.
The Bokarala fidgeted on the steps, knocking each other on their snouts, then sagely nodding. The door to the left opened a crack. A hood-shrouded head poked out at about chest height, the face peering up, vague and blurry.
We don't want any, said a thin, whispery woman's voice.
You don't want any what?
They'll soil the furniture.
Iskarel Pust scowled.
She's insane. Why is everyone I meet insane? Listen, wretched acolyte, step aside. Scrape your pimply forehead on the tiles and kiss my precious feet. I am none other than Iskarel Pust.
Who?
Iskarel Pust, High Priest of Shadow, Magus of the High House, our God's most trusted, favored, valued servant. Now move aside, let me in. I claim this temple by right of seniority, by right of rightful hierarchy, by right of natural superiority. I will speak with the High Priestess immediately. Wake her up, clean her up, prop her up, whatever you need to do to get her ready for me.
The door creaked back, and all at once the acolyte straightened, revealing herself to be ridiculously tall. She swept her hood back to display an exquisitely molded face surrounded by long, straight, rust-red hair. In a deep, melodic voice, she said,
I am High Priestess Sordiko Kwam of the Darujistan Temple of Shadow.
Ah, a master of disguise, just like me!
Yes, I can see that.
You can?
Yes.
Oh, isn't that funny?
He tilted his head.
Not funny at all.
Then smiled winningly up at her.
And what do you think I am, dear?
Some sort of sunburned toad, I believe.
Just what I want you to think. Now invite me in before I lose my temperature.
Temper, you mean?
No, temperature. It's getting chilly.
Her amber eyes shifted to the steps behind him.
What of your offspring?
Ha ha! Offspring they are not. Never mind them. They can weep, they can whimper, they can grovel, they can...
Right now they are all waving their hands about in perfect mimicry of you, Iskarel Pust. Why would they do that?
Forget them, I said.
Shrugging, she stepped back. Iskarel Pust scrambled inside. Sordiko Kwam shut the door and locked it.
Now you claim to be a high priest. From where?
Seven cities, the secret monastery.
What monastery?
The one that's a secret, of course. You don't need to know, and I don't need to tell you. Show me to my chambers. I'm tired and hungry. I want a seven-course supper, plenty of expensive, suitably delicate wine, and nubile female servants eager to appease my delighted whim.
I cannot, alas, think of a single servant here who would touch your whim, as you so quaintly call it. As for the rest, let it not be said I am remiss in according fellow seneschals every courtesy as befits a guest of my temple.
Your temple, is it? Iskarel Pust sniggered. Not for long, but say nothing at the moment. Leave her such pathetic delusions. Smile, yes, and nod. And how in the abyss did they get inside?
The Bokharala were now crowding behind the High Priestess, heads bobbing. She swung about.
I don't know. There are wards. Should be impossible. Most disturbing indeed.
Never mind, Iskaralpast said. Lead on, underling!
One fine eyebrow lifted.
You claim to be the Magus of High House Shadow. That is quite an assertion. Have you proof?
Proof? I am what I am, and that is that. Pray, and perchance all manner of revelation will afflict you, humble you, reduce you to wandering adoration. Oh, he added, wait until she does just that. Oh, the song will change then, won't it just? Never mind servants servicing my whim, it will be this glorious woman.
She stared at him a moment longer, then, in a whirl of robes, swung about and gestured that he follow. The grace she no doubt sought was fouled almost immediately as she had to kick and stumble her way through the squall of Bokharala, each of which bared teeth in rollicking but silent laughter. She shot a glance back at Iskaralpast, but not, he was certain, in time to see his noiseless laugh. Into the sanctum they went.
Not long, Iskaralpast whispered. Those doors need paint, yes. Not long now at all.